Everybody loves the touchdown.
Scans the secondary, throws it over the middle, leaping grab is made at the goal line. He's in, yes! It's a touchdown for Greg Jennings!
The grand slam.
Fly ball to center field. Ethier has done it again. It's a grand slam!
The buzzer beater.
Gets it to LeBron for three for the win. Yes!
But how do those players get to that moment? And who built the venue and signed the contracts? Each week, we dig into the business side of sports and give you the answers. This is Hour 2 of Sports Business Radio.
Come on, boy, can you get it up?
Now, here's your host, Brian Berger, on 95.5 The Game.
Welcome back. Happy Sunday to you. We are celebrating 7 years this week of Sports Business Radio. We're looking back at some of my favorite conversations over that time period. And you heard from Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban in Hour 1. Coming up in minutes, NCAA President Mark Emmert used to be the president at the University of Washington, and he joined me last October. Boy, has he got a lot on his plate. We'll get to that in a minute. Visit my sports business blog. Download the SBR podcast on demand. Go to sportsbusinessradio.com. I'm on Twitter at SB, like sports business radio, at SB radio. Would appreciate the follow. I promise to be entertaining, and I tweet often. This hour of Sports Business Radio, presented by GoutStudyNow.com. Do you suffer from gout? Local doctors need you to help by volunteering for a research study. Go online now to goutstudynow.com/SBR. That's goutstudynow.com/SBR. Or you can call 1-877-859-7560. 1-877-859-7560. Bobby Courser joins me. He's been with us for 7 years. He's been around for the entire ride. And if there's a guy that's facing more pressure in sports right now than NCAA President Mark Emmert, I'm not sure who it is. Because, Bobby, everywhere we look, there's controversy and scandal rocking the college sports world. And I don't want to sound like a doomsday person, but, you know, from what's going on at Ohio State with football, I still think we haven't heard the last of what's going on at Auburn with football. We saw what happened with USC and their football and basketball program. Here locally, Oregon football finds itself in hot water. How's that going to play out? And Mark Emmert is a guy who, at the University of Washington, had to come in and clean up that mess. He's known as an enforcement guy, a guy who carries a heavy stick, a hammer, and he's not afraid to use it. So far, I haven't seen him use it. And he is on the clock, so to speak, with Ohio State. And they're talking about what's going on at Oregon. I'm sure they're keeping their eye on the Auburn situation. UConn, who just won the national championship, is going to start on probation next year. Their coach, Jim Calhoun's going to miss the first 3 games of the season. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of people who think the college rule book is outdated. They're worried about street agents and people infiltrating college sports, dirtying the landscape. The line between amateur athletics and pro athletics has never been thinner. And I think this year, Mark Emmert is under the microscope and the NCAA is under the microscope. And are they going to tear up the rule book and come up with some new current rules? I mean, let's face it, when this thing was written several years ago, decades ago, there wasn't social media, there wasn't email, there weren't cell phones. There weren't a lot of the ways that coaches and schools and athletes communicate. There wasn't Facebook or any of that stuff. Now it's a whole new world. It's a whole new landscape, and you're operating with this old set of rules. At what point does the NCAA say, you know what, it's time to get current, it's time to change the laws? And, you know, I'm not saying necessarily let's start paying players, but there's some old rules that need to be looked at and possibly revised.
No, you're totally right. And it's the old saying that we've talked about with doping. The guys that are doing the doping are always three or four steps ahead of the right. governing body and the guys that are trying to catch them. Same with coaching. And, you know, listen, not all coaches cheat. Not all programs are bad. However, you're looking at people that buy disposable cell phones. You're looking at people that create fake Facebook accounts and fake Twitter accounts to get access to know these players. The rules do have to change. And you're right. I think President Emmert is under the microscope. There's been a lot of these universities that are self-policing themselves. Oh, well, the university has put forth these infractions. You know, Ohio State. Oh, well, they're going to miss the first five or six games. The NCAA hasn't said anything about this yet.
Right. So, and you're right, because what's happened here is that schools are self-imposing penalties in hopes that the NCAA doesn't rule as harshly. I think the NCAA needs to drop the hammer.
Sure.
And they need to set some high-profile examples. And if that means Jim Tressel is out at Ohio State or he gets severe penalties, then that's what it means. If it means, you know, someone like Jim Calhoun having a stiffer penalty than three games. You know, the only difference between Jim Calhoun and Jim Tressel is that Tressel tried to hide it. Calhoun said, all right, you caught me red-handed. And the NCAA, as they showed with USC, they don't like it when you pretend or when you hide or when you play dumb. If you fall on the sword and say, you got me. All right. I screwed up. I cheated. Give me my punishment. Give me my penalty. The NCAA will rule a little less harsh with you. When you say, these NCAA guys, they're a bunch of bozos. I'm going to fool them. They're not going to catch me. There's no record of this. And as John Canzano and other reporters around the country have pointed out, it seems like the media is doing a better job of uncovering some of these scandals than the NCAA is. And the problem with the NCAA is A, their enforcement staff is not big enough, and B, you have the cats guarding the canary, so to speak. So, okay, every athletic department has a compliance office. The compliance office works for the university. Isn't that a conflict of interest? The compliance office needs to work for the NCAA. So if you're a compliance director at the University of Oregon or at Oregon State or at Washington or Washington State or anywhere, you should be reporting directly to whoever's heading up enforcement for the NCAA. You shouldn't be reporting to your athletic director or your coach or someone who may be cheating. Then you look like you're in bed with them. And you're probably going to try and hide some things too. Or, hey, guess what? You're the fall guy. We've talked about that ad nauseum on this show. Compliance officials don't make a lot of money. You want them to be lawyers and have all these skills, but you don't want to pay them anything. The coaches and the people in the athletic department don't really want to talk to them. If they see them walking down the hall, they walk down a side hall because usually it's bad news or it's asking questions that the coaches don't want to answer. It's a thankless, miserable job. And really, you've got no hammer. I mean, if the compliance person goes to Jim Tressel or Jim Calhoun and says, you know what? We got problems here. You screwed up. They're going to say to you, your job is to correct it, fix it, make it look like we're cooperating and that we're legal. And if they don't, guess who the first person is that gets thrown under the bus? It's not the high-profile football coach. It's not the high-profile basketball coach. I have an idea, and I presented it to Mark Emmert. You can hear what that idea is coming up next in my conversation with NCAA President Mark Emmert. He joined me last October here on Sports Business Radio. 7 years of Sports Business Radio. We're replaying for you today some of our favorite conversations with the big-name guests who appear with us on this show. Coming up at 11:15, golf legend Jack Nicklaus. 25 years since he won his sixth green jacket at the age of 46 at Augusta. That's coming up at 11:15. You're listening to Sports Business Radio. We'll be right back.
This is Sports Business Radio. Join Jay Allen and Fletcher Johnson for the Daily Wrap, Monday night on The Game.
fun with those making the big-time decisions that impact your sport. This is Sports Sense on Sports Business Radio. Sports Business Radio.
My guest is Mark Emmert. He's the president of the NCAA. Emmert is the fifth chief executive in the NCAA's history and the second in succession to come from the ranks of school presidents. Indiana's Miles Brand served 6.5 years prior to his death from pancreatic cancer. Emmert was the president at the University of Washington since 2004, and before that served as the chancellor at LSU and Connecticut. Mark, thanks for joining us on Sports Business Radio.
Oh, happy to join you. My pleasure.
So you've been on the job for just a few weeks. Earlier this month, you told the Associated Press the first order of business is to meet everyone in the office, get out there, start listening to the constituents and hearing what their concerns and ideas are. What have you learned so far?
Well, first of all, after a couple of weeks, I have had a chance to get to know all the people of the NCAA national office, and I've been very impressed, Brian, with the quality of the people here, their commitment to intercollegiate athletics, and the work ethic they have. It's just a great place. I couldn't be more pleased with that. Then I've started to move around the countryside a little bit and talk to some folks and meet with those committees that come in here. You learn firsthand the passion people have for intercollegiate athletics. The issues that they're raising with me are pretty much the ones that everyone's familiar with around concern about student-athlete experience and student-athlete well-being, and then, of course, issues around financial sustainability of the enterprise. There's some anxiety, of course, around some of the conference realignments, all the issues that you and your colleagues have been writing about.
You left your dream job at the University of Washington, your alma mater. How difficult of a decision was that for you?
Well, interestingly, the decision to say yes to the NCAA was an easy one because the job's so exciting and just a wonderful opportunity. The decision to say goodbye to the UW, that was brutal. I love the university deeply. I'm incredibly proud of it. It's in a place that'll always be my wife's and my home. But, you know, after 6.5 years, I was pleased with what we'd gotten done. I was proud of our accomplishments. I had in place a leadership team that I have great confidence in. So it felt pretty good when I finally got around to doing it. But it was hard to get myself there.
Yeah, I mean, you did a fantastic job, I think, at the University of Washington. When you came on the job, the athletic department was scandal-ridden. It was on probation. What steps did you take to clean up the program? I mean, that's not an easy situation to come into.
It was very disturbing for everybody that loves the university to see what had gone on there. And there were a number of problems also over on the academic side. And I think universities are not fundamentally different than any other big enterprise. You have to work to start to change the culture. You've got to make some leadership changes. You've got to put confidence in the people that are there and let them know that they're valued. And so in the athletic department, you know, 95% of all the people that were there were great folks, and they'd been pretty well beaten up. There were some cultural issues. I made some leadership changes in key positions and supported them, and all of a sudden we were on the right track again.
So it sounds like your management style is more hands-off. Get the right people in place, put them in the right positions, and then let them do their job. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and then make sure that everybody knows what you want to accomplish, what the goals and objectives are, and then hold each other mutually accountable. Yeah, I think that's right.
I'm joined by Mark Emmert. He's the president of the NCAA. He's been on the job for only a few weeks. Let's talk about some of the challenges that lie ahead for you. Your old colleague at the University of Washington Athletic Director Scott Woodward was recently quoted in the USA Today saying, "The NCAA is worried about abiding by jaywalking rules when we have serial killers on the loose." I think Mark understands there are a lot of people out there who really need to be looked at and scrutinized. And instead of the NCAA worrying about how many text messages a coach sent to a kid, we need to catch the guys who are doing really bad stuff. On that point, I think you'll see some radical changes. Mark, over the past few months, things have changed significantly with the NCAA cracking down on improper contact and relationships between agents and student athletes. We've seen high-profile programs such as USC, North Carolina falter. There's a piece in this week's edition of Sports Illustrated where former sports agent Josh Lux confesses to paying as many as 30 college athletes, describes the influence agents have over college athletes and their inner circles. Might we see you expand your enforcement staff in an effort to solve this problem or at least make it better?
Well, I haven't made any decisions about expanding staff in that arena, but I'm very pleased with that work that's been going on to try and tackle the agent issue. It's a very good example of the complexity of some of the challenges that we face, and the only way you can really get at the root causes of those issues is through collaboration with a variety of folks. The NCAA can't do it alone. We have to have support of professional sports and the players' associations and of the coaches and of the many, many agents who are very good actors and for whom this is a very important profession. And then, of course, we have to also hold student athletes accountable for their behavior. And so what we need to do is, to go back to my good friend Scott Woodward's flowery quote, is we do have to focus on the big picture and take on these issues, but bring other people into the fold and try and get behavioral change to occur. It's not just about enforcement. It's also about education. It's about making sure that we're rewarding the right kind of behavior and punishing the wrong kind of behavior. It's going to take a systemic approach to really make progress.
Well, I totally agree with you on engaging organizations like the NFL Players Association, the NBA Players Association. This quote from Steelers coach Mike Tomlin last Friday to the Pittsburgh Gazette: if we really want to sink some teeth into the situation, we'd have lifetime decertification for agents who offer money or had people who work for them offered money. I would think that a quote like that get some people's attention and gets people to the table to talk about who are some of these agents that are being certified. Because I've said on this show for a long time, I think it's too easy to be certified as an agent, and that's why you see some bad agents out there.
Yeah, I think that the comments like that, the actions of the NCAA in recent months, the attention that a number of leading college coaches have given to it, our conversations with Commissioner Goodell, for example, in dealing with football issues, all of that is adding to a sense of seriousness of purpose here that I'm very pleased with.
You've got compliance officials at the schools, but you've got so many athletes at each school, and in most cases, a small number of compliance officers. And frankly, a lot of the coaches and the people who work in the athletic department, they run down the hall when the compliance officer's coming their way. They just really don't want to talk to them. What do you do about getting the compliance officers to feel more comfortable with the people that they're trying to help and vice versa?
Well, as is always the case at a university, just like any other kind of enterprise, it starts at the top. You have to have presidents who are engaged in intercollegiate athletics. They have to understand what this enterprise is all about. They've got to work with their athletic directors and make sure the athletic directors understand what kind of culture and behavior they want to see. And then the ADs have to work with the coaches and the compliance officers to make sure that they've got a positive, constructive working relationship. There's a lot of really good examples out there of best practices where the compliance officers aren't just the cop on the beat, but there's somebody who's working with the coaches all the time saying, all right, what do you want to get done here, and how can we make sure that this happens within the rules of the NCAA? And when you see that going on, then you've got a program that's going to be run well. And there's many, many good examples of that. We just need more of them.
We're joined by Mark Emmert. He's the new president of the NCAA. Mark, the Reggie Bush penalties at USC kind of brought a familiar resolution. Student athletes left behind pay the price while the perpetrator goes free. The same thing happens with college coaches whose programs incur penalties. Then the coach goes to another university to start with a clean slate. Doesn't there have to be a better way? And I know you're new on the job, but I would think this is an issue that has also captured your attention.
Yeah, of course it is. You want to make sure that what you're doing is encouraging the right kind of behavior and punishing the wrong kind of behavior. So holding institutions, universities, accountable is a good thing, in the sense that everyone needs to understand the seriousness of these issues, and then you start to shape a culture inside a university where good behavior goes on. And so I've been very pleased, for example, with what I've seen from the new president and new athletic director at USC. They seem very serious about this, and I think we're going to see a really big change of culture there, and that's a good thing. You also, though, do need to recognize that we need some vehicle within which we can hold the people accountable who engage in that behavior. Once they leave college, the college ranks, the NCAA's arms don't reach that far, and so that's where we need cooperation and help from people in professional athletics and in other parts of the sports enterprise.
I've got an idea for you. I want to get your thoughts on this. So if you're a college coach, you leave a program, the program goes on probation, and you stay within the college ranks. There's nothing you can do about the Pete Carrolls who go to the NFL, at least as far as I know. Give them a driver's license-like document. If you have a driver's license and you speed or you get a parking ticket or you have any kind of a violation, it goes on your record. If you did this with coaches, then maybe there's some sort of a penalty that they can carry with them from one school to the next, and then it's going to make that school that's hiring them think twice about hiring them, thus penalizing them, because they can't just leave the problem and go to start with a clean slate. What do you think of that idea?
Well, as you know, the NCAA does, under certain conditions, ask for and does receive suspensions of coaches from various activities. And so the NCAA does go after coaches. But, you know, the idea of coaches being held accountable for academic performance over, you know, their career as well as their compliance with the rules, I think is an issue that's well worth talking about. And it's the kind of conversation I'd certainly welcome inside the association.
More of my conversation with NCAA President Mark Emmert coming up next. You're listening to Sports Business Radio. We'll be right back.
This is SBR. Back with more after this.
Sports Business Radio with Brian Berger.
Now back to my conversation with NCAA President Mark Emmert. Larry Fitzgerald, the wide receiver for the Arizona Cardinals, said last week he probably built the school library and paid for the salaries of 100 professors. This was his comment on the revenue that Tim Tebow has generated for the University of Florida. That was what he told the Arizona Republic. And then, you know, we see the NCAA has signed a 14-year, $10.8 billion TV deal for the men's basketball tournament. Is it time to start paying college athletes? And if we don't pay them, should there be a different sort of system for athletes with how they're compensated?
No, we absolutely should not pay student athletes because, as the title student athlete suggests, they're not employees. You know, they're students. They're at the university to participate in their sport, most certainly, but also to be a part of that campus and to get an education. They are supported in everything that they want to do. They're provided with an opportunity to excel in their sport with great coaching and great facilities and a great competitive opportunity. They're provided with remarkable educational opportunities and terrific support for that. The relationship simply has to be one of a student and an institution, not of an employer and an employee. Is there a chance that we should, or an opportunity for us to think about the size of their financial aid package, their grant and aid, to make sure that we are covering the full cost of attendance? Well, sure, that might be something worthy of discussion. But the reality is that that we should not in any fashion be paying students to be members of teams. There's a huge misperception about what goes on with the money that comes into intercollegiate athletics. You know, very, very few, somewhere around 20 or fewer universities at any given year have enough revenue to cover all of the costs of their athletic programs. The $10.8 billion contract that the NCAA signed is, of course, over 14 years. When you look at the money that flows back to those universities and supports the championships for the student athletes, more than 95% of all the resources flow back out to the institutions, and the NCAA just passes that money through in cash and in services back to the institutions. But you know, people see those kind of numbers and think that there's some big cash cow here, and that's just not the case. I promise you, Tim Tebow, for all of his wonderful talents, did not build the library at the University of Florida.
See, but that's, you know, you hit it on the head. I think that's one of your biggest challenges, and it's been a challenge of the NCAA for a long time. When the common person sees, oh, the NCAA signed a 14-year, $10.8 billion TV deal, they go, wow, that's not amateur athletics, that's big business. But you guys are trying to tell us that, hey, this money is being filtered back into the schools. And I think people forget, I talked to Dr. Brand about this, that this is paying for golf, this is paying for lacrosse, this is paying for soccer and the other non-revenue generating sports. And that's a lot of money to run all of those sports as well.
Well, that's exactly right. And you know, that's why there's only about 20 or so schools in the country that actually break even in sports. Everybody thinks that college sports are a huge cash cow for universities, and in all but a few exceptions, they actually require infusions of cash. And so the real question for university presidents is more on the sustainability of the enterprise, not how do we milk this thing for money. It's ironic that presidents are worrying about exactly the opposite of what the sports viewing public is worried about.
And what is that?
Well, and that's the sustainability of it financially, that these... You know, if you look at, it's been well publicized now, University of California, Berkeley, they had something like a $10 to $15 million annual shortfall in their athletic budget. So they're eliminating four or five sports right now and trying to figure out how do I deal with this big shortfall. Well, here's a famous program playing in the Pac-10, participates in all of the TV revenue, and yet the cost of the programs still draws from the rest of the university, not the other way around.
Well, and maybe that's why you have commissioners like Pac-10 Commissioner Larry Scott out there trying to form super conferences so they can go out and make an even bigger media deal, TV deal, so there's more money and programs like that don't have to be cut, right?
Yeah, I mean, part of the conference alignment structure and a variety of other things is at least in part about money. There's no doubt about that, and every conference wants to position themselves as effectively as they can. I think people also overestimate the role of money in all of those decisions, because having said in those conversations in several different conferences, the universities also worry about who are their peers, who's in their intellectual and academic peer group. They want to be associated with the right schools. And so if you look at any of the moves that have occurred recently, a significant part of that was schools saying we want to be affiliated with those other universities for academic as well as athletic reasons. And that's a big motivation for university presidents.
We've got just a few minutes left with Mark Emmert. He is the new president of the NCAA. Mark, there's a new book out. It's called Death to the BCS. The book questions many things about the current system in Division I college football, but one of the main questions for many is why the NCAA would outsource its most profitable product, postseason football. There's no other sports entity that contracts out its postseason. Seemingly, you're leaving a lot of money on the table in a day and age when, like we just talked, programs are having to cut sports. Why doesn't the NCAA organize postseason football like it does with NCAA men's and women's basketball, and even in other divisions of college football?
Yeah, well, first of all, the decisions about the postseason in football are made at the local institutional level. Individual presidents and the conferences have decided long ago that they wanted to play through the bowl system. You know, we've never had a championship in Division I football. And there's, as you know, of course, a deep commitment to those relationships with those bowls. Student athletes like the participation in the bowls. They all like the opportunity to play in the postseason. And the NCAA hasn't had the same relationship with football as it has with other sports for 20 or 30 years. And so every year we come up to this time of the season and we start looking at the BCS rankings, and everybody gets anxious about it. There's a couple of good things that happen. One is we're all talking about college football. That's not inherently bad.
Right.
And secondly, you know, it provides a lot of attention to who's winning and who's not around the conferences, and I think that's good. Our position, my position at the NCAA, is that this is going to be a decision that presidents are going to have to make. At the NCAA, we know how to run championships. We run 88 of them, and if they want us to help them with some new structure, we're more than happy to do so. But the decisions to work through those bowl games weren't the NCAA's. That was something that was established by individual universities and conferences long ago.
And I guess my question isn't as much about the system, a playoff versus the current system. It's, again, you know, why doesn't the NCAA just say, like Greg Shaheen has been on this show, I think he does an unbelievable job with his staff that you have there in Indianapolis of running the college basketball men's and women's championships. Why doesn't the NCAA just do the same thing for football? Is it because your staff isn't big enough so you need to contract it out? That is kind of puzzling to me.
Yeah, well, it's not something that the NCAA on its own can decide. You have to remember that the NCAA is a volunteer association. And so our members, the presidents that run those sports, are the ones who actually make that decision. So when you say the NCAA, of course, you mean all of the universities and colleges that are the members of it. And so far, the presidents of Division I have decided they prefer the current bowl system to other structures.
All right. Give us a glimpse of the human side of Mark Emmert. When you're not on the job, when you're out with your family, when you're strolling downtown Indianapolis, what do you like to do?
Oh, I like to do most anything outdoorsy. I love to fly fish and spend time on a golf course once in a while, not as much as I'd like to. And I enjoy skiing and all kinds of outdoor recreational activities. I'm also a sports car nut. I have an old Triumph TR6 that I enjoy spending time fiddling with and laying underneath and trying to keep alive and well. And then, of course, you won't be surprised to learn I love intercollegiate sports.
Yeah, I mean, you've always been on a college campus. Now you're not. Do you kind of miss that?
Well, not yet. I'm sure there'll be a few days when I just have to see college students. And fortunately, the NCAA office is, as you know, a campus, so I can just stroll a few hundred yards and see college kids when I want to.
Your predecessor, last question, the late Dr. Miles Brand, appeared on this show several times. I found him to be candid. I really enjoyed our conversations. He became known for academic reform. When you walk out of the doors of the NCAA offices one day for good, what do you want your legacy to be?
Well, first of all, you know, the academic reform movement, I hope we stop talking about it as reform, and I hope we start talking about it as simply the embedded culture of student athletes, that we have complete and utter expectation of high academic performance. It's not something new, but it's in fact something that's just a continuation of all the things that we do. I hope that we have a set of rules and behaviors in place that make sure that our student athletes are having very, very high quality experiences on their campuses and in their competitive life, that they are able to take full advantage of everything that a university has to offer. We had an event here last night where we named the woman athlete of the year, this incredible swimmer from the University of Arizona, who's also a Rhodes Scholar. And I was listening to her talk, and I realized that she's the role model of what we want. I mean, not everybody's going to win a Rhodes Scholar, but she'd taken full advantage of everything that a great university can provide, and that's what I want. I want more and more students to be able to walk away from intercollegiate athletics, having been able to develop their mind and their body the way that we all want them to do.
Well, and I guess on that note, something that we always seem to forget, these are young people. These are not professional athletes. These are not 40-year-old, you know, mothers and fathers. These are young people. And I think because they've become so good at what they do and because they're so well-spoken, that a lot of times we forget they're young people, right?
Absolutely. These are kids that are growing up. And they, as our ads say, there's 400,000 of them, almost all of whom will go professional in something other than sports. You know, that's exactly right. You know, for them, sports is not a job. This is their avocation. They do it because they love it. Of course a number of them would love to go play professional basketball or football, but the vast majority of them don't have those intentions. This is just part of what they do as they grow up and develop. And frankly, it's a great thrill for all of us to get to watch that occur. And it's too easy to forget when you're watching somebody in football pads or you're seeing somebody do some physical act that uh, is is just amazing that you're dealing with, you're talking about and watching and dealing with 18 to 21 year old kids, and that's the business we're in. We're in the education and development business.
Mark Emmert, the president of the NCAA. Mark, I've enjoyed this conversation, and I wish you the best of luck going forward. I hope we can catch up again soon.
I'm sure we can. Thanks, Brian. My pleasure.
Thank you very much. You're listening to Sports Business Radio. We'll be right back.
Podcast this show and any other past SBR episode at sportsbusinessradio.com. Back with more SBR after this.
Hope you enjoyed my conversation with NCAA President Mark Emmert. It's available for on-demand listening at sportsbusinessradio.com in our interview section. In that section, you can find my conversations over the last 7 years with some of the biggest names in sports, the key decision makers that we talk to every week right here on Sports Business Radio. We're with you every Sunday here on 95.5 The Game from 9 a.m. until noon. Bobby, high-profile incident took place in Los Angeles, opening day, Dodger Stadium. A Giants fan beaten in the stadium parking lot. And the Dodgers have taken a ton of criticism for that beating. And look, there are some things you can control. There are some things you can't control. You can't control every single aspect. Most people ask you to control the building. Make sure there's good security in the building. When you start talking about parking lots, especially at a stadium, it's a little bit more difficult. Is there any excuse for this? Absolutely not. But the security staff for most pro sports teams, it's not so big that it can be covering parking lots as well. Because the Dodgers have been under such intense scrutiny, this week they hired former L.A. Police Chief William Bratton to assess their stadium security measures. This is according to the L.A. Times. Bratton served as the L.A. Police Chief for 7 years before leaving in October of 2007. He's going to evaluate the Dodgers' policies and procedures related to security and fan services at Dodger Stadium. He's scheduled to work with the organization to develop a security blueprint for the stadium and the parking lots. He's going to be consulting them immediately. I think the Dodgers are going to wind up in a lawsuit over this. The fan who was beaten is in very, very bad condition, may have serious and permanent brain damage. And, you know, when you go to a game, you don't expect to get beaten. Look, if you're a fan and you buy your ticket, you can root for your team. You can root against the opposing team. But we've seen Raider fans in Oakland. We've seen Dodger fans. We've seen Giants fans. We've seen Steelers fans take it to the next level. You throw a drink on someone. You swear around their kids. Here in Portland, hey, you know what? I've sat around Timber's Army a time and again, and I think they're terrific, and I think they're passionate, but would I have my daughter anywhere near that section? Not in a million years. There's a fine line between being a fan, which is short for fanatic, and being someone who's committing a crime. Beating someone senseless in a parking lot, Bobby, that's a crime.
No, it totally is a crime, and it's not right. And, you know, listen, I never hope that a professional sports organization gets sued, but they failed to protect somebody on their property. And you're right, you cannot go against, you know, you cannot protect everybody, but you should be able to provide an environment where everybody feels safe, regardless of what team you're choosing to cheer for.
The problem is that, like I said, you can't be everywhere at all times. So, you know, one of the things that I think comes out of this is, at least for Giants games and rivalry games, you're probably looking at Dodger staff ramping up security, not only at the venue, but in the parking lot.
Sure.
Do they put cameras in the parking lots, monitoring what's going on? Maybe. You know, there's going to be a lot of changes here. There's probably going to be a lawsuit. And it's going to be an interesting case because, you know, unfortunately, that there's going to be a situation like this that happens again in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not in L.A.,
Maybe it's in Oakland. Maybe it's in Pittsburgh. Maybe it's in Detroit. Maybe it's in Chicago. Maybe it's in New York. Hopefully it's not here in Portland. But it's going to happen again. And what happens as the ruling in this case is going to set the blueprint for future cases. Now, if this had taken place inside the venue, I'd say the Dodgers are screwed. But because it took place outside in the parking lot, but as you point out, Bobby, still on Dodgers property, they own the parking lot, they own all the land around Dodger Stadium, what responsibility do they have to be able to protect their fans even when they're in the parking lot on the way to their car? That's going to be the interesting ruling here. All right, coming up, our third and final hour of Sports Business Radio. We're celebrating 7 years. We're looking back on some of my favorite conversations. We've already heard from Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban. We heard from NCAA President Mark Emmert. Coming up in a mere 15 minutes at 11:15, my favorite conversation ever on Sports Business Radio, golf icon Jack Nicklaus. Fantastic conversation, insightful. Jack Nicklaus like you've never heard him before. That's coming up at 11:15. You're listening to Sports Business Radio. We'll be right back.